Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Have you had a boss who's prone to getting mad? Well, it seems Seattle City Council members see that in their boss. Text messages obtained by the Seattle Times show a heated exchange between Mayor Ed Murray and Councilmember Sally Bagshaw. At one point, Murray asks Bagshaw to call him and promises he won't yell. Josh Feit is politics editor at Seattle Met magazine, where he writes the local politics blog, Publicola. I asked him what Murray and Bagshaw were texting about.
The city council basically wanted to make sure that the mayor wasn't doing these dramatic sweeps of the jungle, the homeless encampment in southeast Seattle by I-5, and wanted to make sure that he was doing reach out. People were getting services, and Murray kind of cringed at that limitation, the way that they were framing it, that he was doing sweeps. He hates that term. And so he was basically, he texted Councilmember Bagshaw, who was the sponsor of this resolution, and what looks like from these text messages, threatened her.
Well, he said, quote, "I will, if you do a resolution on homelessness, et cetera, I will stop all cleanups through the city," which I took as a reference to cleaning up homeless encampments. I don't know. "And pull police off enforcement." So you think he meant?
I don't know what he meant. And I would agree with your assessment that it sounds like what it sounds like he's saying, and he's done this before. He folds his hands to his chest and he says, "Oh, yeah, okay then." And he kind of threatens you with doing what you're accusing him of doing. And, you know, if you really think I'm such a meanie, I'm going to show you a meanie, which looks to me like your typical Murray temper tantrum when he faces criticism.
Well, I think what the listener basically wants to know is, should I be concerned that my mayor is a hothead, or is this just good politics and we got a glimpse into it?
That's right. The irony here is that when Murray was a candidate, he ran against the previous mayor on a style issue. He said, "This guy's a bully. He makes a fight out of everything, and I'm going to get stuff done." Now, ironically, you see, there's this hothead issue with Mayor Murray himself. But the litmus test comes on, is he getting stuff done? Is it bleeding into his performance? I would argue that it's not. Look at the list of the guy's accomplishments.
Well, right? Can we start with what the outcome of this text exchange? I mean, eventually, he and the council got together, didn't they?
That's right. And so I would say you're quite right. Look, Sally Bagshaw kind of ends and defuses this somewhat explosive story, I'm using air quotes, because they agreed on a policy, they passed a resolution, and she cheered Mayor Murray. So that, to me, doesn't sound like it's bleeding over into, if you want to apply metrics to what he's getting done, it's not bleeding over into his performance.
Yeah, well, you have followed his performance. I wonder what you make of his relationship with the city council and whether this little exchange affects that one way or the other.
Well, you know, I would say with the exception of a recent high-profile loss on the Sonic Stadium, where I also think he was doing some bullying behind the scenes, you look at what he's gotten done with this council, right? The $15 minimum wage, the affordable housing grand bargain where he got developers to pay for expanding space, the preschool levy, the rideshare agreement that he got the council to sign off on between taxi cabs and rideshare companies. And he's teaming up with the council on every one of these measures and policies. So again, my assessment is hothead, bully, whatever, it's not affecting his work. I would say there's a major thing to flag, and that is it affecting his staff? And you have seen, he seems to have higher turnover than usual. Two of his closest allies were his successive communications directors, and they both left. He lost two top communications directors in his first 2 years in office.
Do you think when he was sending those texts, he was thinking about how texts are publicly available?
Look, this is a guy who, speaking of his communications director, had to be peeled off of going on Facebook at 3 a.m, had to be told to not give his cell phone number out to reporters. This is a guy that clearly has an anger management problem, or he's childish or juvenile. I don't know. But no, I don't think he was thinking about that. Obviously, he doesn't think about that. He hits send. He hits post. He picks up that phone, and I don't think he thinks about it. And I think that's a challenge, and I think that's why you see two communications directors leaving.
Finally, Josh Feit, what have you learned about Seattle politics from looking at this exchange? Because we talk about, are we process-y? Now it's, are we hot-heady? What are politics like today in this city?
You know, I think we've known Mayor Murray as a hothead for years.
Going back to the legislature?
Going back to the state legislature, right? He's defensive. And in fact, I did a big story on the $15 minimum wage campaign. The lead of my story was Mayor Murray throwing the door open and cursing out the players in the room and saying, "You're effing me," you know?
I remember that story.
And what happened 2 weeks later?
Done.
Done deal. Now, cause and effect? I don't think so. I don't know or not know. I don't know if it's, I don't think it's his temper tantrums that are getting things done. But I think what people are missing is he seems to be getting stuff done.
Do you think this would be a non-story in another comparable city?
I think an argument with a council member over texts, over them challenging you. I think it happens.
It wasn't insults and personal threats.
I didn't see him cursing her out and calling her names. I mean, you know, what you do see in this city is, you know, 3 weeks ago when the five female council members voted against the stadium, is they got attacked by the public with horrible name calling. So all of a sudden we're angry at the mayor.
Gas.
You know, come on, people.
Come on, people. That's Josh Feit, politics editor at Seattle Met Magazine, who writes the local politics blog Publicola, giving his opinion of some text messages exchanged between Seattle's mayor and a city council member. You can read those texts yourself in full. We're tweeting out a link to it right now. The Seattle Times story will tweet it out at KUOW. Coming up on the program, if the big earthquake hits, maybe we'll all be saved by ham radios. That's coming up in about 20 minutes. KUOW is The Record. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill Radke. It could be the worst natural disaster in American history, a 9.0 earthquake that fully ruptures the Cascadia subduction zone, the massive fault that lies off the Pacific coast. The tsunami to follow could wipe out entire communities on the coast, places like Ocean Shores and Westport. The death toll could reach more than 9,000 in Washington alone. That is why over the next 4 days, officials are preparing for the worst by testing their emergency response. One of the key planners in this drill is Lieutenant Colonel Clayton Braun with the Washington State National Guard. He told KUOW's Emily Fox about the immediate aftermath of a mega quake.
So many bridges drop that people become isolated within their own communities. It becomes a difficult time to even move around in your own community. Of course, the power's out everywhere and for a very long time. To paraphrase one of our coworkers here, it's kind of like being thrust back into about 1850, and now you're stuck in the Old West. All of the infrastructure stops working. There's no communication. There may not be running water. The ability to handle sewage is gone. Your medical capability is extremely overwhelmed. It becomes a very bad scenario, quite honestly.
Walk us through this disaster drill. What's going to happen?
Well, one of the big problems after the rupture of the CSE is that a lot of the, what we call lines of communication, you can think of them as all of the avenues that bring logistics into Western Washington, they all become non-usable for a period of time. And I'm talking about railway, I'm talking about highways, I'm talking about our seaports and our airports. And so what we're doing, our big piece of the plan is to try and help bring in all that sustainment as fast as we can after the rupture. And we do that by creating logistics bases throughout Western Washington. So largely that's what our rehearsal is creating logistics bases. What we're really talking about is bringing in everything from utility repairmen to food and water and medical supplies and medical responders and trying to get them as far forward in the disaster area as we can, trying to get them from wherever in the nation they've come from to exactly where they are needed so that they can help people across the state of Washington.
How prepared do you think Washington State is as a state in terms of a big earthquake?
Unfortunately, I would say that Washington is not very well prepared at all currently. When you look at other nations out there like Japan, we all saw in March 2011 the big earthquake in Japan with the tsunami, and we saw the devastation and the loss of life. And it's amazing when you stop and you remember that Japan is arguably the most prepared nation on the planet. They have put a lot of effort and preparation for that, but they still took a pretty significant hit. We have not put near that much preparation in here, so our damages could potentially be significantly worse. We need to be thinking about that. We need to be preparing ourselves, our houses, our neighbors. We need to do it now.
Ultimately, what do you hope to accomplish with Cascadia Rising?
It's about rehearsing our plans. If we can rehearse our plans and identify what works and what doesn't work, what needs improvement and what doesn't, this exercise is not the end of a road to preparedness. It's only a waypoint along that road to preparedness, and this is just a way to help us get better. We're going to continue working on this until the ground begins to shake under our feet, and then at that point we stop preparing and we start executing.
Talking with KUOW's Emily Fox, that's Lieutenant Colonel Clayton Braun of the Washington National Guard. He's one of the key planners of this four-day emergency response test. The disaster drill is called Cascadia Rising. I know, it sounds like a bakery or an arts festival, but Cascadia Rising is actually a drill that begins today. It continues through Friday. When phones and computers are down, local ham radio operators are ready to pitch in, too. Ham radio, we'll talk about that later this hour. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Quote, "I was impressed by how bright the lights are on this cable. It works amazing. Can't wait to buy a few more." That is a review for a phone charging cable on Amazon. And last year, Amazon sued the party responsible for writing it because it's obviously not a real review. It's more of a paid ad masquerading as a review. Well, now Amazon is going further. It's going after the people who pay to get fake positive reviews of stuff they sell. At the tech news website GeekWire, editor Todd Bishop tells us what's at stake here.
When you look at the landscape for online reviews, Amazon reviews are actually critical, not just for products on Amazon, not just for things that people buy on Amazon, but you could be sitting at the hardware store and you're looking at a shelf and you say, what do people think of this? Well, you go to Amazon. That's your tendency. So this really has become almost the Bible, sort of a crowdsourced consumer reports that many people turn to even beyond their Amazon purchases. So them being authentic and real and actual legitimate feedback from real customers is an important issue, not just for Amazon, but for people broadly.
If Amazon knows which reviews are fake, why don't they just delete them?
Well, there are so many products on Amazon. It is a bit of a Wild West. They rely heavily on computer algorithms. Those algorithms scan the product reviews and look for signs of fraudulent reviews, but it would be a Herculean task and really impossible for humans to go through and say, okay, that's fake, that's real, that's fake. And so it is a difficult computer science problem, and they also are now looking to the courts to help them out in terms of squelching a lot of these fake reviews.
Yes, Amazon is trying to block sellers who pay for the fake reviews, basically kick them off the site and take away any illegal profits they make. First of all, are fake reviews illegal?
Well, if they violate the Amazon terms of service, it's essentially a contract violation. So in that way, Amazon does have some recourse through the courts. And so they are taking this action. This latest action was notable because it was the first time they've actually targeted sellers who buy fake reviews. In the past, they've targeted people who write fake reviews and companies that sell fake reviews, if you can follow all of that. There's many marketplaces that we're dealing with here, and some of them are legitimate and some of them are not.
How much is Amazon just doing PR saying, we're purifying our reviews, and how much would this legal move actually work?
This is obviously a signal to the sellers that buy these fake reviews, hey, we're going after these three companies. That's essentially what they're doing. don't you be the next. So this is, in many cases, a PR move against those sellers to send them a message. That said, it's a very difficult balancing act here for Amazon. They, at the same time, are trying to reassure customers that the vast majority of reviews on the site are actually legitimate. And so at the same time, they're doing the PR campaign to get the attention of the sellers. I think they want to try and make customers feel comfortable with the reviews that are there.
How crooked are Amazon reviews compared to other sites?
I think they're probably somewhat in the same. If you look at something like Yelp or other sites, every site out there that has a large consumer base, many businesses, they're going to run into these types of issues. And so I think Amazon is unique in its scale. Amazon itself is giant. It's essentially the world's largest online e-commerce site. And so as a result, everything that they experience to a much greater degree than many other sites.
So how should we deal with reviews? Should we just ignore the ones that talk about a life-changing phone charging cable? Do we just ignore all reviews? What's your recommendation?
So the advantage here is that humans still have some advantage over algorithms. I think that you can use your judgment when you look at these reviews. If there are common patterns, misspellings, broken English in some of them, there are some telltale signs of a fake review that I think humans can see and discern that the computers cannot. You know, another thing is looking at the stars, not just the actual words, but looking at the stars. And if you see a bunch of 5-star reviews and then a bunch of 1-star reviews, that's another sign that, hey, maybe there is some artifice here, that the 5-star reviews might be something that the company is paying for, and the 1-star reviews are the actual real customer reviews.
Amazon isn't going to get rid of the funny fake reviews, are they?
Boy, I hope not.
They have that list. Right? That they keep this, like there's a product called the Bic Crystal Pen for her, and a review is Hulk sad. Hulk demand Bic for him, which I believe might be a fake review. So
Exactly. No, that is, Amazon customer reviews are a medium unto themselves in many ways. And there are people who are extremely good at them. And there are people who are extremely good at writing fake ones. So it's a bit of a Wild West, and you just got to be careful what you're reading.
Todd Bishop with the tech news website GeekWire. Amazon's now going after people who pay for fake positive reviews of the stuff they sell. However, those funny fake reviews live on. We are tweeting out a link to Amazon's own list of humorously bogus reviews. Join us on Twitter at KUOW. I recommend you read the reviews for the banana slicer and the horse head mask. You're listening to KUOW Seattle. 50 years ago, Marcia Botzer left the United States for Europe. She wanted to learn more about the labor and social movements happening there. And while she was there, she overheard something that changed the direction of her life.
Oh, I remember one night in San Marco Square in Venice, I'm sitting with a group of other folks, fell into conversation, and I heard from someone who knew someone, quite literally this is true, who knew someone, who heard about someone who had a friend who may have made a gender transition. At that point, I took the thought, I'm not the only one.
Today, Marcia Botzer says that realization, I'm not the only one, is a lot less common for transgender people. And at least here in Seattle, that's partly because of the Ingersoll Gender Center, a support and advocacy organization for gender variant and trans people. Marcia Botzer founded the Ingersoll Gender Center, and she told Ross Reynolds she started it in part because of what happened after she came home from Europe. Everyone thought she was a boy except her. And that conversation you heard about in Venice was sharp in her mind, so she started making calls to doctors and counselors to talk about her gender.
I don't feel right. I don't think I'm a boy. And people, the kind ones would say, well, I just don't know anything about that. The others would say, well, I can't help. Goodbye. Very difficult to deal with. So I returned to the working world and made attempts over time to connect with some kind of help. Finally, goodness sakes, it hit me that if it isn't in the world, what did I learn from that labor time? What did I learn from Paris? What did I learn from all that? Then we make it ourselves. But I looked around, I had no idea how to do that. And it wasn't until I encountered the folks at Seattle Counseling Service, it's represented here, the oldest LGBTQ counseling service in the country, possibly the world, who knows, that it really began to be possible that there might be something that would answer my questions directly.
When was this about?
That was in the late 70s. Yeah, and I encountered some excellent work that was being done there in Seattle Counseling Service.
Well, in the meantime, how are you kind of dealing with it in your own life?
Not well. There just was nowhere to turn with that kind of a question for me, other than these attempts I've mentioned to contact professionals. There was a nascent and difficult program at the University of Washington for a short period of time that I did hear about, but it was impossible to connect with.
Well, aside from professional help, how about just people in your life, your family, your friends?
Oh, I wouldn't tell a soul. You know, if you've heard the stories of the lesbian and gay individuals who fought so hard and hid so deeply because there was nothing else to do, there is a similar pattern, at least for me. One of the titanic differences between then and now is that there are so many individuals, especially in a city like this, where that's not the case anymore. But it sure was for me, so I didn't tell them.
So you were trying to get some recognition of what you were going through, and it sounds like meeting a lot of frustration in that effort, but then you did.
Yeah, it's life is like that, isn't it? I mean, it doesn't just really come at you full-blown and complete. It sort of slips in the back door, and that's pretty much what happened. But there were support groups and forms of that kind of work going on at Seattle Counseling Service. I met some other folks who did, in fact, identify as transsexual. That was the word we had at the time. We didn't even have the word transgender yet. And that's how it got going. And I began to do more work with that. And by the early 80s, it had coalesced. Well, actually, the late 70s, it had coalesced in my mind to create a center that would respond to the needs of people like myself and people facing gender identity questions.
And that became the Ingersoll Center.
It certainly did. As I said, gone back to work, and I used to hang out at the library all the time because, goodness sakes, with these thoughts in my mind and everything else, there wasn't much. I just couldn't get going on anything else. And there was a book one day on the table in the library. It said Ingersoll on it, and I thought it meant the compressors, you know, you see out there. So I opened it up, and it was Robert Greene Ingersoll, a great free thinker from the 19th century. And his first essay just captured me, so...
Does it have to do with sexual identity?
No, nothing. And as far as I know, he never spoke on orientation or identity issues at all. No.
What about what he wrote spoke to you?
Oh, my goodness sakes, Robert Ingersoll. Well, his free thinking is probably why I don't hear about him so much anymore. But he spoke for the rights of women and children. He spoke on civil rights. He was incredibly eloquent about belief systems and why, in most cases, they must be challenged. In those years, he was 1833 to 1899, so you can imagine what kind of response he received. But he was apparently quite the orator because he spoke to more folks prior to microphones, so I'm told by researchers, than any other citizen of the States. I mean, he was all over. But that doesn't really matter so much as what he said.
Yeah, well, is there something that he said that kind of sticks in your mind, a phrase or...
Yeah, I'll bet. Yes, indeed, there is. I often include it in my comments with folks I'm working with, and it's this. The time to be happy is now, the place to be happy is here, and the way to be happy is to make others so.
So?
To make them happy. Yeah. Now, we might not say make in our age, but what he was obviously saying is that let's help each other. That's a great source of happiness. And it is.
How is Ingersoll different than these other things that were going on that were paying some attention to these issues?
Well, it took the concept of a support group, which in those days and today as well, is a welcoming and safe space where you can come in, you can talk for a few minutes about what's going on in your life. It took that concept and made it 100 times safer, and 100 times more heard. In other words, we would train group leaders and facilitators to listen incredibly carefully and incredibly passionately to whatever the individual was saying, because we really didn't have much language for all this sort of experience. And those groups became the heart of Ingersoll's work, and they still are. All these years later, we still do those every Wednesday night. We haven't missed one in, Well, in all these decades, we haven't missed a Wednesday.
This was brand new. What are some of the things you learned from this deep listening about how to work with people?
Well, it's really nothing surprising. It's pretty simple stuff. People will appreciate being heard not just for a moment, but deeply and fully for a few minutes of their lives. They may not have that time anywhere else in their week, but they could come to us and they would have it with us. And it's gone on and on now. Today, we still do support groups on that order, but we sometimes will begin with everyone together, and then groups break out to face special questions like family issues or male to female or female to male or genderqueer. Or we have employment groups now. We even have a thing called Team Hack, which is for the folks who love to make little electronic things as part of our employment project. But all that was in the future.
Was it difficult for you to kind of come to terms with that before you opened the Ingersoll Center and tried to work with others on these issues?
Well, I think it's an ongoing process, you know. Especially, I've talked to so many of the early organizers around lesbian, gay, bi, and trans stuff, and we all say the same thing, that we were learning as we went. We were listening to each other, trying to make sense of all of this. Since then, now we have mountains of evidence-based medicine. I'm part of an international organization, so on and so forth. But we didn't have it then. We had the feelings.
Sitting here talking to you about 30 years of the Ingersoll Center, Marcia Batzer, one might think that it was pretty much a straight line from 1962 when you're questioning, in a straight upward path to where we are today. Was it as linear as that, or were there sometimes two steps backwards?
Oh, goodness sakes, not at all linear in many respects. From the early 60s to now, in terms of Ingersoll, for example, you know, the flag that is on the wall here, we used to call it our old battle flag because we carried it in every parade and all that sort of thing. It's not what we use anymore as our main flag. But it's there because a great fellow, Pat Butler, a good friend of mine, a gay man, he and I sat one night. We talked about, what are we going to do? We want this banner. And he sewed it up. He sewed it up over a few days, and there it is. But even what to put on a banner is my point. We were unsure of it, and we went back and forth and so on and so forth. What kind of language to use? There's been a great deal of discussion worldwide about what kind of treatment, especially Western world medical and psychological treatments, should be available for transgender people. And some of them have been very rigid, like requirements to live 2 or 3 years full-time in the gender role to which you are moving before you could even receive any kind of hormonal care or something like that, which make no sense. And yet, at the time, the thought was, well, we just don't know what's going on, so the powers that be would impose these kind of positions as the best thought of the moment. Well, it's been a struggle through those kinds of things. So on the care level, that has been a tremendous and ongoing struggle. The latest issue of the Standards of Care by the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, that's the international guidelines, evidence-based medicine, that folks use. The last version 7, has the amazing line in it that transsexual, transgender, and gender nonconforming people are a diversity, not a pathology. And that's coming from the medical establishment.
What's that mean, a diversity?
It means it's not sick. It's not crazy. It's not evil. It's not sinful. And it's not bad. It is just who you are, and how are we going to deal with that so that you can get on and be the very best you can possibly be. Uh-oh, I'm getting going here. But that's the idea.
When you look at here in Washington State, in Seattle, where do you see things needing to move toward where they are not yet?
Yeah, where to go? That's an excellent question. Immediately comes to mind health access and availability. Huge issues. And access, of course, contains issues like class. For example, how do you pay for it? The new healthcare system, very helpful, but not clear at all yet what it will mean for transgender people. Those kinds of things need a lot of work. Policy needs a lot of work, so that it isn't just the Fortune 500 that have policies, and they do, for transgender transitions, but it's every other corporation around that has them, that every school has policy, that there is no place no place where a trans person needs to be afraid. I mean, that's a big order. It really is. So we've got a lot of work to do there. We really do.
Marsha Botzer founded the Ingersoll Gender Center here in Seattle in 1984. She talked with KUOW's Ross Reynolds in 2014 at the Museum of History and Industry during an exhibit there called Revealing Queer. And we're tweeting out a link to a storytelling project that was part of that exhibit. We're live tweeting the show right now at KUOW. You're with KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. For the next several days, emergency responders will test how well they can react to a magnitude 9.0 earthquake. When that big quake hits the Puget Sound region, one of the best technologies to rely on for communication might not be cell phones or computers. It could, in fact, be radio, amateur radio. The city of Seattle has something like 3,000 people with amateur or ham radio licenses, and a few dedicated ham radio enthusiasts volunteer for the city every week practicing their emergency communications. KUOW's Jamala Henderson went to Seattle's Emergency Operations Center downtown.
Very nice.
We have another net on this frequency right after ours, so we need to be off by 7:30. Pardon?
It's 7 o'clock on a Monday night. Time for volunteer members of Seattle's Auxiliary Communications Services to check in.
Good evening. This is Kathy, and my call sign is Kilo Foxtrot 7, Tango Tango Mike.
Kathy Schumann has been an amateur radio hobbyist for about 4 years. Tonight she's on the Emergency Operations Center's radio frequency, leading the communications check-in.
We follow a script, and we invite our members to check in small groups.
This is Kilo India 7, Bravo Delta Golf.
This is how Seattle Auxiliary Services members keep their radio communication skills sharp. It also lets them know who's out there and where they are.
Mike in North Central.
After the members finish up, then come announcements. Then visitors or non-ACS members are welcome to check in. In order to be a volunteer with the city's ham radio group, first you have to get an amateur radio license. That costs just $15. Kathy Schumann got interested through working with Red Cross.
It's reinforced my commitment to preparedness and getting to know your neighbors and being more self-reliant and when you know that a disaster could happen at any time.
Seattle's Auxiliary Service has around 140 members. On a given Monday night, maybe 30 will check in on the frequency. The Volunteer City program has been around since 1993. Carl Leon is a military vet who's been a ham radio operator for 25 years. He's been volunteering with Seattle's ACS for 7.
One of the beauties of amateur radio is we're already every place throughout the city.
This is November 4, Romeo Delta Zulu, Ron, West Seattle, no affiliation.
People from Capitol Hill, Finney Ridge, and North Seattle piped up this evening. Even folks from Bothell and Puyallup.
We can talk from here to the Snohomish County EOC. We can talk from here to Kitsap County, Pierce County.
Unfortunately, not everyone gets the clearest signal when trying to check in.
Could the last person please repeat their call sign?
But Leon says there are other signals that hams, as he calls them, can use if there isn't a direct signal, like satellites or even...
Amateur radio operators bounce signals off the moon.
For what purpose?
To talk to someplace for fun.
Leon says they have a couple of HF, or high-frequency radios, in Seattle's emergency operations for longer-range communications. They can even send email or digital messages using their radio signal.
My name is Mike Malloy. My call sign is Kilo Foxtrot 7 Delta Tango India.
Malloy likes to refer to ACS ham operators as professional amateurs. He says they may be volunteers, but they're trained by the city to deal with its particular emergency protocols.
I like recognizing people's voices, all these nets. To me, that's being when something real happens, I'm able to know who I'm talking to on the air. So I know I can trust this person because I've heard them and I know who they are.
Kilo Golf 7, Oscar Delta Bravo, Dean in North Seattle.
So when disaster strikes, your neighborhood's superhero might just be an amateur radio operator.
We're going to be at home, we're going to be at work, we're going to be at school, we're going to be just like everybody else in the community. Except most ham radio operators carry a radio with them.
And when the earth moves and the big one hits,
we're going to turn our radio on, we're going to turn into this repeater that we just used, and we're going to touch base with whoever's running the operation, the net control operator, for Seattle ACS.
This concludes the Seattle Auxiliary Communications Service Monday Night Net.
Jamala Henderson, KUOW News.
Good night, everyone.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW, 94.9 Seattle News and Information. That drill, that emergency preparedness drill, will continue through the week. Well, today is a key moment in the presidential campaign. You know, California, New Jersey, four other states are voting, and I want you to know that KUOW is going to bring you live election coverage tonight. That begins at 6 o'clock, so I hope you can join us. The big news on the campaign trail today is that the latest politician denouncing comments from Donald Trump is a Republican who endorsed him. House Speaker Paul Ryan says Trump made the, quote, textbook definition of a racist comment when he said an American board's judge isn't qualified to preside over a case involving Trump University because of the judge's Mexican heritage. Ryan said the comment was absolutely unacceptable, but he still thinks that Trump is better than Clinton. KUOW Seattle. How do you feel about fracking? Would you read a novel about it? Nancy Pearl thinks you ought to. Here she is with Marcy Silman and a recommendation for Heat and Light by Jennifer Haig.
Well, the interesting thing is that I'm not quite sure what the title has to do with the novel.
Ooh.
But this is a novel that I was looking forward to because I'm a fan of Jennifer Haig, the author. And I'm always interested to see where she's going in her literary career. Jennifer Haig's novels and short stories are primarily set in a small Pennsylvania mining town. And the mining town, it's dying. The mining companies have left. Coal is no longer the king that it was.
And so all of her novels are set in the same
in
place?
In Baker City, yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
So why are you a fan of Jennifer Haig's?
Jennifer Haig is somebody who can take something like a small failing Pennsylvania mining town and give you a sense of what's happening to the people there. And in this one, this is so up to the minute because into this failing mining town or failed mining town that is on top of the Marcellus Shale, what they discover is natural gas. And the people in the town, the farmers in the town, the small the bar owner's son, various people have to decide whether to let the oil company drill.
Fracking.
Fracking. Yes.
Do you need to have read all the previous novels? No.
No, you don't need to have read all the previous novels. I think you might want to go back because I think you would be very impressed, wowed by her writing, but that's not necessary at all. It's one of those books where we might have an opinion about fracking. We might see the results of fracking, for example, what's happening in Oklahoma now as a result of all of that. But in this book, it's not as easy as that. It's not as easy to come down on one side or another. And I think, you know, great praise to her for doing that.
Interesting. Heat and Light is the name of the book, which, Nancy Pearl, you say has not a whole lot of bearing on what happens.
Well, not that I could find, Mercy.
and the author's name is Jennifer Haig. Nancy, thank you for bringing this in.
You're welcome, Mercy.
The book is Heat and Light, and that was Nancy Pearl talking with KUOW's Marcy Silman. You'll find more of Nancy's book picks at our website, kuow.org. Are Seattleites complacent in the face of hatred? Last month, two colleagues were chatting at a Starbucks on Capitol Hill when something outrageous happened. It was loud, it was hostile, it was racist and sexist, and virtually no one in that Starbucks stepped in to help. Those two colleagues are Yoshiko Hardin and Bob Hughes, both college administrators. She's at Seattle Central. He's at Seattle University, both African-American. They told me what happened, and I want to warn you before you listen that you might find the language here very disturbing.
It was Friday morning. We had a 10 o'clock meeting at Starbucks just to catch up. Bob and I have known each other through the education system for a while, and I'm new to my role at Seattle Central. So he reached out to say, would you like to meet? I hear you're back kind of on the hill and at the college, which is great. So we met. It was about 10:30. We were about a half hour into our meeting, and I felt something warm on my face and my forearms. And I thought that someone had tripped and spilled their drink, their warm drink. And so I looked over, and there was a young white male looking at me. And can you swear on radio?
We can try.
Okay. So, and I looked at him, and he said, you know, "F-ing nigger bitch." And I kind of stopped. And it was at that point I realized it was spit on my face and hands, that he had spit on me. And then he kind of wound up to do it again and spit again and got on me again. And for sure, at that point, I saw that it got on Bob and got on his coat. And then he yelled again and just kind of casually walked out. I got up to get some napkins, and he stood at the window and was yelling. We couldn't hear him, but assume he was yelling around the same language, same thing.
What did you guess at what was going on in his head? What do you think it was about?
Well, in that moment, I thought he's gonna kill me, is what I thought. And, you know, my professional background, 15 years working in race, ethnicity, justice work, and studied all of these type of scenarios, and have been called all of those names before, but never just someone popped off. You know, usually like I cut them off on the freeway or took their parking spot. So that was what was stunning to me. Many people have said, well, he must be crazy, quote unquote, or he must.
That's the first thing that came to mind. If he's yelling for appropriate of absolutely nothing.
Yeah. So I've seen people, I know people in my family, I see people around my job who I think might be mentally ill because they're displaying behaviors, like talking to themselves. And he wasn't displaying any of those behaviors. So my first thought was, do I know him? And then I thought, he's going to kill me.
If you'll remember, it's actually my first question to you. Do you know this guy?
Yes.
After he had walked out, because he's a much smaller man than I am. I wasn't particularly afraid, but I was kind of trying to figure out, where does he come from? And I agree with Yoshiko. I walk up and down James and Pioneer Square every day to get to work. And I've got a pretty good sense of when somebody is mentally unbalanced or displaying those kinds of behaviors. That's not what this was. This was anger. This was hate. This was someone who saw her and decided he was going to unleash his anger and hatred.
How did the people around you react to what had happened?
Well, there was a woman, a white woman, who was down near the till where you order food. And she was the person who said, manager, manager, your customers are being called racial epithets, I think is the language she used. And they're being spit on. And that's how the manager was notified that something was happening in the store table area.
But what struck you both, it sounds like, was how little reaction there was outside of this one woman, this one white woman.
Absolutely. After the incident, we waited at least an hour, maybe an hour and a half for the police. We didn't go anywhere. We were in the same spot. Nobody approached us. Nobody looked at us. Nobody talked to us. It was as if the incident didn't happen.
And this was a mixed race crowd or all white, or who was there?
It was a mixed race crowd. So it was very diverse. There were other black people in the Starbucks, and there were other black women. There were white people. I mean, it was a regular busy morning, people on their devices, people coming in and out.
And what did it say to you that there was so little reaction?
That it wasn't important. That, you know, something that had really changed my life didn't show up as meaningful or impactful for others besides Bob and the woman who came over. And I think one of the things I said to Bob after it happened is, this is so bizarre. Like, this just happened to us, but yet everyone's life just goes on as if nothing has happened. You know, you can still hear the machines whirring, you know, making milk steaming, like nothing stopped.
And that is bizarre to me. If we had been in a car wreck, would people have just walked by? Would people have stopped and tried to do something? It's been really interesting over the last month or so since the incident, and I posted my blog. I got a significant number of responses of people saying, well, no wonder they didn't respond. No one responded. You didn't respond. Well, I don't expect that anyone would physically intervene in an instant when neither one of us were physically responding. We were shocked by it. But I do expect that people would involve themselves afterward, as this woman did. I mean, the woman who notified the manager made a point of coming up to me and to Yoshiko and saying, look, this should never happen to people, and if you want a witness, I'm here. That seems to be sad to me that only one person did that.
Is what you were hoping for basically what that one woman did?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I was hoping for. I mean, some of it's in retrospect, but even the police, when they came, the police officer said, I'm surprised that no citizens intervened. Sometimes people will intervene to hold someone until we get here. So they even noted, like, no one said stopped or even said anything to the person, like, get out of here, or, you know, challenged the young man who did this.
I want to ask you, I wasn't there.
Yeah.
But I wonder if maybe I'm one of these people, white male in my case, although there were others there, I might have been one of those people who wouldn't have responded. I'm trying to put myself in that space. For one thing, somebody yelled, I'm looking away, I probably didn't see spit. When I hear someone yell, even something like what he yelled at you, I think I probably would have thought there's a fight going on, even though there wasn't, right? It was probably a fight that didn't involve me. I'm not sure what's wanted of me in this situation. I might have kept on looking at my device. And I wonder, since the rest of the crowd isn't here, you can put it on me. Like, what does it say about me? What are you thinking that that says to you?
It says to me that your own personal whatever activity is more important than the community in which you're engaged. That seems to me a mistake. I think you need to look. If you hear something like that, you need to say, what's going on here? Is this something that does concern me? Because frankly, it was. This is a public space in which somebody assaulted two people. And if you allow that to happen as a member of a community, then what do you want from your community? What happens when it happens to you? Do you want somebody to be there to at least pay attention to the fact that you're being assaulted? It seems to me that the action is to ignore, and that's not something that you should do or I should do. You know, if it had been a child being beaten by an adult, would you have paid attention? If it had been somebody taking out some sort of weapon and hurting somebody, would you pay attention? At what level do you start paying attention? And my point is, if we're going to live as part of a community, we need to be aware of those things that happen. And let's say that this was a young man who knew us both and decided he was angry with us and decided to assault us. Well, regardless of that, you have a responsibility to know that that happened. You have a responsibility to not necessarily intervene. Again, I make the point that I don't expect people to intervene. I do expect people to pay attention.
My first reaction was that, man, I don't, a ruckus, something broke out. I don't think I would have said anything. It's not my business. But as you're explaining it so vividly now, I guess, yeah, I hope I would have at least said, are you okay?
I think that's all it takes for a community to act as a community. Something that simple.
Well, what gets us thinking about this is when you draw a connection between being quiet at a Starbucks, you know, in a case like this, a connection between that and a silence, a denial, an apathy, you start to hit people where they live, because I don't think most of our listeners, or at least most of our white listeners, I'm not sure would make a connection between looking at their device, looking away, and a bigger apathy.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can support causes, right? And then it's another thing when it is there in your face. It's a different test, you know?
You know, here's something else, confessions of a white person here. It's awkward to come and say, that man just yelled horrible things at you. You know, I don't stand with that. I'm one of the good white people. It, you know, there's something that feels a little self-congratulating and patronizing about that. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I think that's something
like
white people
you can handle yourself.
I think that's something that, you know, like my white colleagues and friends who support our anti-racism work, that's something that they deal with, is wanting to be supportive but not patronizing, and wanting to participate but not come in as if they're going to run it and own it. That's not how I would have experienced that, but I think that's something that's a fair statement, right? That I now approach this, you know, black couple as a white person who just experienced an assault by another white person, and what is that going to mean to them?
Right. So what's the right way to insert in a way that's respectful of you, of everything that's gone on?
What you said earlier, I think, is really a strong statement. Are you okay? Come and ask me if I'm okay. Don't ignore me. Don't look away. Don't pretend that nothing happened when something really did. We have the Seattle nice culture that we talk a lot about and we laugh about it. But underlying that are some really deep truths about who we are as a community in terms of being engaged with people who are different than us. We're more segregated today than we have been as segregated today as we have been in this city's history. I mean, look at our schools, look at our communities, who lives where. You know, all of that has significant impacts on how we interact with each other. And if we don't ask questions, if we don't engage, and especially when we see something deeply going wrong, if we don't engage in that, then we're at danger as a community of further segmenting, of further isolating ourselves from each other, and we'll never come to being aware of each other and our needs.
That's so interesting to think of even something as outrageous as that to have been an opportunity to just ask you a question. How are you doing? That stands in for so much, so many opportunities.
Yeah. I mean, I'll tell people, just say, I don't know what to say, but I feel really uncomfortable. I mean, I think we put a lot of pressure on ourselves to have it all perfect and processed and just, you know what? I don't know what to say in this moment, but I feel really uncomfortable about what I witnessed. And are you all okay? It doesn't need to be perfect.
Yoshiko Harden and Bob Hughes, both college administrators here in Seattle. Bob is an associate dean, Seattle University. Yoshiko, vice president of student services at Seattle Central. Yoshiko told me that what happened to her was traumatic, that she has been depressed, anxious, unable to focus, to sleep, and she wants you to know this is not an isolated incident, that this is part of the fabric of how racism and sexism play out. And I'd like to know, is that your experience? How have you personally seen race and gender and difference dealt with here in Western Washington? And what is your part in it? Write to us at record@kuow.org. KUOW has republished Bob Hughes' essay about that coffee shop incident. It's part of our Seattle Story Project. It's up now at KUOW.org, and we'll share a link to it right now on Twitter. It's @KUOW. Thanks for listening.